906.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The standoff continues in Egypt between supporters of Egypt's deposed president, Mohamed Morsi, and backers of those who wanted him deposed, including the country's military. Over the weekend, military officials warned they'd disperse huge pro-Morsi sit-ins that have become fixtures of public squares in Cairo, and that they'd start early this morning. But so far, the crackdown has not happened, although reports say the atmosphere in the capital is extremely tense. And that tension is a continuation of what's been a tumultuous 2 years for Egypt. In early 2011, a popular uprising brought down longtime President Hosni Mubarak. The military took power briefly, but promised elections, which were held a year later. In both parliamentary and presidential balloting, the Muslim Brotherhood was the winner, with Morsi chosen as president. But this summer, protests erupted at the one-year anniversary of Morsi's rule against what demonstrators saw as his increasingly anti-democratic tendencies. And so the military resumed power, Mr. Morsi is detained somewhere, and the streets of Cairo have again become scenes of protest and conflict. These events are more than just headlines for some Granite Staters, including our guests today, each with a connection to Egypt. And this hour, we'll get their thoughts, concerns, and hopes for that country's future. And let's get you into our conversation, too. If you have ties to Egypt, tell us what you're hearing from contacts and family there. Also, if you have general questions about what's been happening, join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have four guests for the hour. Joining me in studio, Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement. And Wayne, it's always nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Lauren. Good morning.
Also with us, Jeannie Sowers, assistant professor of political science at UNH, Middle East analyst for the Congressional Research Service. Jeannie was in Egypt earlier this year. She wrote a book on the Egyptian Revolution called Journey to Tahrir. And Jeannie, a big welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Also joining us from the Boston area, Nadine Farag, secretary of NGMA, an Egyptian group from Harvard and MIT that is looking for long-term solutions to Egypt's problems. Nadine has Egyptian parents. She spends summers in Egypt. And Nadine, great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Bahat El-Aididi. He's an engineering consultant. Bahat was born in Egypt, came to the U.S. in 82. He's lived in New Hampshire since 2002. And Bahat was in Egypt just recently. He came back. He was visiting family over there in July. And Bahat, welcome back to you, too. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
Well, and Bahat, since you're the one who just got back, what's the latest that you're hearing from family and friends in Egypt? And what were your impressions when you were there just last month?
It's interesting that the thing that I've seen this time that wasn't seen before is that different opinion on both sides, and that's even within the one family. I have seen one family where a brother would be a pro the brotherhood, and the other brother will be pro the change that happened recently. And there, each side will be passionate about it. And it's kind of like, you know, people here in the country, you know, some people Democrat, some people Republican, but it's happening within the same family. I have seen also like father would be pro brotherhood and mother would be pro the change that happened recently. And sometimes the father and mother on one side and the kids on the other side. People are concerned. People don't know where the country is going. This is kind of like uncharted territory. And they are also kind of confused about the West, how they stand with these issues. They feel that they're getting some sort of conflicting messages from like U.S. policy. They don't know if their U.S. policy is with or without or against the change that happened recently. So that's very much kind of sums up, you know, the general feeling for the people.
Wow. And we'll definitely talk a lot this hour about those messages from the West that you mentioned, Bahat. What did you see yourself when you were there?
I stayed in with one sister that's north of Cairo. And I stayed also with another relative south of Cairo. So I was basically crossing the whole city of Cairo almost like every day or every second day. I was passing very close by the camp for the pro-Morsi that's in Nasr City in Rabaa al-Adawiyya. I would be like passing about maybe like a mile away from there. I could see the army closing the roads going there. I never been to Tahrir Square during that visit. I went off to Alexandria for another family visit. In Alexandria, things were quiet. I went there for one day, and I went through areas that had been hot spots before, but they were very quiet. And same thing in Alexandria. The people I met there, half of them are, you know, roughly half of them are pro-Morsi, and the other half is are pro the change that happened. In Egypt, I was in Cairo. I was fortunate that I didn't run in any of the trouble spots there. It was regular, everyday traffic in Cairo. And if I didn't know anything about the news, I probably wouldn't have felt that there's something happening that serious in the city there.
So even though we've got all this news coverage of these big, big camps, these sit-ins, these people who've kind of dug in for the long term, right? They've got electricity, they've got internet, they've got tents, they've got kitchens. You can walk around Cairo and not even know that this is going on?
That's basically what happened to me. And I remember like a couple days I was leaving from a family visit at night, like almost like 12 after midnight. And I had my niece with me, and the streets were crowded. People were all out. Transportation was crowded. Traffic was jammed there. And one case when I was there, the confrontation that happened near Rabaa, by the way, and a big number of people got shot and got killed overnight. That happened like early in the morning there before almost everybody went out. And that was very much near the camp over there. So if you're like a mile away or 2 miles, you probably wouldn't feel much happening there. You just get it from the news.
Wow.
And it's just the unfortunate thing is I mean, it's a very, very real scenario that you can run into one of those hot spots if you don't know where you're going, or if accidentally things, you know, heat up in one area.
Well, yeah, it's
so
really...
Anytime you're out, I mean, if it is safe, yeah, but you gotta keep your guard. You gotta you know, stay alert and, you know, see where you're going and watch the news. And many times when I travel from one place to the other, I would usually check with family and friends, and I get an update. What you hear on the news, because things are moving very fast, what you hear in the news is probably always old news. It's late. Things change every minute, so you got to get the best update from people who just traveled the road that you want to travel.
Well, Baha, it's great to get your sort of firsthand impressions, and I'll definitely have some more questions for you on that. But I want to bring Nadine into this as well. And Nadine, as I said in the introduction, you often spend summers in Egypt. Did you go there this year?
Yes, I was there at the beginning of June. I was there for a family member's wedding. And it's very interesting. Much of what Behet said is I definitely agree with. When I was in Cairo, it was obviously before the protests, and something about the city felt very sad to me. I remember coming home and telling a friend, it's sort of like watching somebody that you love die. It was this feeling of just an overwhelming mood that people had lost hope. And the other thing that I found really interesting was there was a sort of physical representation of that, because there had been some electricity rationing and the city was really dark. And for anybody that's been to Cairo, it's very bustling, bright, and energetic at all hours of the day, really, but especially at night. It sort of comes alive then. But it felt different this time. There was the minarets, which, you know, will normally light green, were completely dark. The Cairo Tower wasn't lit. So I was walking through Khan al-Khalili, which is the city's old bazaar, and, you know, there weren't that many tourists there to begin with, and then the electricity on half of the street turned off, and it did. It just sort of felt like a very you know, physical representation of the mood. So, and I think people from everywhere, from all walks of life, the taxi cab drivers and professors, Muslims and Christians, I think everybody was feeling this sense of, you know, a loss of hope in the current situation. That was sort of what I felt.
Well, and tough for you, Nadine, right? Because your organization, NEGMA, kind of got started when Egyptian Americans said, this revolution in Egypt is great, and, you know, what can we do to help further this cause of, you know, economic development and so forth in Egypt?
Right, absolutely right. So Enigma was established by a group of us. Some of us are Egyptian-Americans, some of us are Egyptians just studying in the Boston area. And we wanted to get together and really talk about how we could empower people at the grassroots level to come up with interesting and innovative ideas for social and economic development in Egypt. And as you know, Egypt is facing, in addition to some of these political and economic problems, some really intractable problems with water and sanitation. There are some human rights issues across the spectrum relating to minorities and women, but also people with disabilities who are very much marginalized from society. So the idea of Enigma was to sort of empower people, young people, old people, anybody that had an idea for Egypt, to really contribute in some way, to put together a business plan, and we would sort of help them network with local partners on the ground in Egypt in order to really move their idea into reality. And something that we were also really passionate about was this idea of an exchange between Egyptians living abroad and Egyptians in Egypt.
Yeah.
So an exchange of talent and ideas and skills. For us as an organization, obviously, when we see problems on the ground, we feel there's even more need for the work that we're doing. But it is a hard time. It's a hard time for people to get encouraged to think of exciting ideas, for people to think that there's hope in the work that they're doing, for sure. So it's presented some problems for us.
Yeah, super disappointing for you, given, again, that your organization sprang out of all this hope and optimism concerning Egypt. So, Nadine, that's where you're at now. You're kind of in a waiting, holding pattern, it sounds like.
Right. Yeah, we are, trying to continue to gain traction on the ground for the idea of entrepreneurship for social and economic development in Egypt. But the situation on the ground is difficult, and there are many Egyptian Americans who really are taking a distance from Egypt right now and who are trying to wait and see what kind of happens on the ground. So
okay.
We're waiting to do that, but we're going to continue forward with our work. And we've done two conferences at MIT in the past 2 years, and we're hoping to do another one next year, so to continue with our work.
Well, and after a short break, Jeannie Sowers and Wayne Lesperance, I want definitely your thoughts on this sort of watch and wait and uncertainty that Nadine and Bahat described to us. Also, your thoughts on U.S. policy. We'll start taking your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
19. This is NHPR. Looking for something to do this weekend? Look no further than your NHPR member card. With it, you can take advantage of our August Benefit of the Month 2-for-1 discount at the Silver Center for the Arts in Plymouth. For more about the member card and the doors it opens for you, visit NHPR.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Monadnock Music, presenting string quintets by Dowland, Schubert, and Parker with cellist Rhonda Ryder and the Monadnock Quartet on Saturday, August 17th at 7:30 in the evening at the Peterborough Townhouse. MonadnockMusic.org. And Centurion Insurance Group of Hanover, New Hampshire, offering personal, commercial, and wholesale brokerage insurance services to clients nationwide at CenturionUSA.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the situation in Egypt through the eyes of Granite State analysts and those with family connections to the country. We invite your questions and comments, too. If you have ties to Egypt, tell us what you're hearing from your family or your contacts there. Also, if you just have general questions about all the turmoil that we've seen in Egypt recently, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Jeannie Sowers is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UNH, extensive experience in the Middle East and Egypt, along with Wayne Lesperance, Professor of Political Science at New England College, and our other guests, Nadine Farag, Secretary of Enigma, an Egyptian group from Harvard and MIT, and Bahat El-Aid. He's an engineering consultant who was born in Egypt, lives in New Hampshire today. And Jeannie and Wayne, I haven't forgotten about you. And Jeannie, to you first, because you were in Egypt earlier this year. Given your extensive knowledge of this country, Jeannie, how surprised are you that Egypt has ended up in this spot again, where we've got demonstrations in the streets and this kind of scary standoff?
Well, I think, as Nadine and Bahat said, I think we're all very sad and disappointed. I was there in February and March, and just as they said, people were very frustrated, angry, and also very tired of the uncertainty. I mean, it's been a long 2 years. That being said, I think a lot has changed, and I think what is very difficult for both the Brotherhood and anyone going forward is that there has been no stable sort of security presence, and there's been no reform of the police force. So the real problem is that people want some sense of security, and that contributed to this kind of popular movement for the ouster of Morsi that triggered the military intervention. But we have the same problem that we had when Mubarak was overthrown, which is that it's very difficult to tackle reforming these internal security services. But unless you do, you can't have any real transformation in the political system. So in a way, we're seeing the failures of both the leadership in the Brotherhood and the leadership in the opposition to really grapple with some of the reforming of the central institutions of the state. It's the biggest challenge facing Egypt, and it's one that's just going to take a very long time.
And Jeannie, you know, you talk about the Muslim Brotherhood and the other side, so to speak. Can you just briefly lay out for us who these sides are and whether there's more than two, as is so often portrayed?
That's a great question, Laura, because I think one of the most unfortunate things to have happened now is what Baha was talking about. So this polarization into these two broad camps is a very recent phenomenon, and it's really not representative of Egyptian political opinion. So the best indication we have for the kind of diversity of political opinion in Egypt is the parliamentary election that we had between November 2011 and January 2012, because it really was the first open, unrigged election since, you know, actually decades and pretty much ever. So the first thing we see if we look at those results is that the Freedom and Justice Party, which is the Muslim Brotherhood's party, it won a majority, but a pretty slim majority. So it won about 37.5% of the vote. Then parties, another Islamist group of parties that is considered more conservative than the Brotherhood, took 27.8% of the vote. And then two kind of coalitions of liberal secular parties took 18.1% of the vote, so almost 20% of the vote. So that tells you right there that in a very fluid situation, there was hundreds of political parties. Some of them coalesced into these alliances. But really, there was an enormous diversity and plurality of views, of political views. And so what's happening is that as the political debate gets framed into Islamists and non-Islamists, you lose actually all that diversity and all the real sort of differences among Egyptians. And I think that's one of the saddest things to
Wayne, let me bring you into this. Jeannie describes a very fluid situation, a very diverse situation. So what kind of a predicament does this put U.S. policymakers in?
Well, it's very tough for lots of reasons. Number one, there's not a very strong understanding of exactly what's happening on the ground in Egypt. I think Jeannie has it exactly right. You know, we boil it down to either you're Islamist or you're not, and it really you lose all the subtlety of the range of political opinion in between. To describe a strong secular movement in Egypt is sort of a misnomer. It's really more of a sliding scale of Islamist points of view, and there are some secularists. The other problem is language. So what happened on the 3rd of July, most people would describe as a military coup, but the U.S. government will not call it that.
Oh, that's a good point, Wayne. People are dancing around that word.
That's right. And the reason why is because if it is a military coup that leads to the losing a duly elected leader, then U.S. foreign aid has to stop according to U.S. law. So, you know, it complicates our own political ideas and how we're going to approach Egypt. The overall challenge for the United States is that Egypt is in a state of transition, and we're not exactly sure how it will go. We also don't know what we can do, if anything, to navigate a conclusion that is a positive one. And we've come from a time of Mubarak for 30 years, a very stable, very predictable leader who did a lot of awful things, by the way, but he was very predictable, to now having had, you know, two or three different leaders in the last 2 years in Egypt. That was instigated most recently by basically a military coup.
Well, Wayne, over the weekend, there were real fears, as you know, that the military would crack down on these sit-ins, these demonstrators, these camps, whatever you want to call them. They didn't. And it's very tense, but there was real concern over the weekend that things were going to sort of blow up again. It didn't happen so far. I wonder what you think about that. I wonder why you think that didn't happen and whether it has anything to do with warnings from the U.S., Wayne, over the weekend that if things get really bad and violent, we might pull our aid.
Well, so the breaking news on this was last night there was a statement issued by the Egyptian military saying that within 24 hours they would be dispersing those camps.
Right.
So stay tuned on that. The Europeans have spoken pretty loudly about this, and human rights organizations in particular, that what they want to make sure does not happen is massive bloodshed. The Muslim Brotherhood has said that we are here, we are not leaving, and we are prepared, you know, to be martyred over this. So the stage is set for something that could be very quite awful. Let me just go back for a second to something Bahat said as well. There is something about the Egyptians in general. I've been twice to Egypt, spent a significant amount of time there. And to hear both Nadine and Bahat describe a very somber, almost sad place is so counter to what I experienced there. There really is a very vibrant culture, very positive nightlife, lots of things happening. And to hear it described the way they have really tells me this is a country that is undergoing a really sad change. So this stage has been set for this confrontation. How it is resolved, who knows? I think Jeannie made the point earlier that a lot of the precursors that led to the original revolution in 2011 have not been resolved. The economic situation, the way Christians are being targeted and treated by some Islamist groups, a lot of these, the lack of freedoms, this reform hasn't happened. In many ways, it can't happen as quickly as the people want. So here we are, Laura, in a position where the people are demanding something the government does not have the capacity to give them.
Well, and who is the government at this point?
And right. So that's the situation.
Well, let me invite our listeners again to join us, and then I definitely want to follow up with all of you. The number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions, comments, thoughts about what's happening in Egypt and what the U.S. response should be is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Bahat, since we started to raise it, I want to go back to what you said earlier. Your friends and family said they were confused about the Western involvement in this. What would you, Bahat, like to see the West, meaning the United States and Europe, do in this situation?
Well, at least from defining the position, the two sides, of course, each one looking for a favorable definement for the position that, you know, sway things to their side. And in the beginning, the U.S. Government said that we haven't decided yet or something, you know, to these words, if it is a coup or not. That did not please both sides. During the time, you know, for the days that followed this, both sides were frustrated with the U.S. Kind of inaction or to define the position. Lately, when, for example, McCain visited Egypt and he made some discussion there, and he said words that kind of more favor the position of the Brotherhood by defining this as a coup and saying that they were, you know, unjustifiably jailed their leadership. So the Brotherhood usually kind of hang on anything that comes to their side. So quickly they switch positions and said that we're happy with the U.S. position. Of course, the other side was frustrated. The people just they believe this is an Egyptian problem, and they're the only people who can solve it. Nobody can solve it for them. But at least they don't want to see mixed signals from outside. They want to see a defined position, and definitely like everybody see it, would like to see it in their favor. And you're not going to say something is going to please both sides. You're either going to please one side or the other.
So should the U.S. just not say anything, or?
Well, I guess they want just the U.S. government to take one position.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to please someone and upset the other, but at least they want to know what the U.S. position is. Right now, they can't really tell, you know, if the U.S. position is with the, you know, the change that happened or against it.
You know, Jeannie, love you on this too. And then Nadine, I have another question for you. What do you think, Jeannie? What difficulty does this present to U.S. policymakers as Baha is outlining, no matter what the U.S. says, somebody's going to be unhappy?
Well, I think Egyptians in general have ascribed more power to the United States than it currently has in Egypt. And I think he's exactly right. This is a long-term revolutionary process, actually. And the only people who are going to turn in that outcome is the various forces at play in Egypt. And the reason that Egyptians ascribe more power to the U.S. than we actually have in Egypt right now is because they look at Libya and they say, oh, well, you know, we got involved in getting rid of Gaddafi. And then they look at Israel and Palestine, where the U.S. is heavily involved. And then they look to Iraq. So the expectation that the U.S. can actually set the agenda is not warranted in the case of Egypt, but people still believe it anyways. I just want to say something about the military coup, because the U.S. is in a very difficult position because it is a military coup. It also happens to be a military coup that had support from a large, but certainly not a majority necessarily, part of the population. So we have a popularly supported coup, which is not actually unusual in revolutionary circumstances. But the U.S. can't call it a coup because of the reason that Wayne said. And the reason that the U.S. wants to continue military aid to Egypt is not really about Egypt only. It's about basically keeping the peace with Israel. So U.S. military aid is simply a gift to Egypt for signing the Camp David peace agreement. Now that the U.S. is trying to reengage the Israelis and Palestinians in talks, this is actually the worst timing possible for losing whatever kind of leverage or mediation you have with the Egyptian side. And then there's the really difficult problem of security in the Sinai Peninsula, which is the area of Egypt that borders Israel, which has been a demilitarized zone since the Camp David peace treaty in the late 1970s. So Wayne is absolutely right. The situation is actually very difficult for the United States because we have a whole set of interests, only one of which is Egypt. And it's, of course, not in the American sort of either interest or desire to say that one side is right or wrong. I mean, that's completely inappropriate. So they are in a difficult position, and the reason they don't call it a coup, even though it is a coup, is because they do want to maintain military aid for a whole set of geopolitical reasons.
Wow, that's interesting. And there were some skirmishes in that Sinai area that you mentioned, Jeannie,
yes,
over the weekend. You know, Nadine, I want to ask you another question. What has the impact of all this unrest, all this uncertainty, been on the Egyptian economy? And the reason I ask is, you know, it stands to reason that if the economy gets worse, the unrest is going to get worse. But go ahead, Nadine.
That's a great question. I mean, I think when I was there in June, I certainly felt that this dissatisfaction with the economy was sort of the single largest and most unifying complaint amongst Egyptians on the street. The Egyptian economy has been sort of decimated from many different angles. One is the loss of tourism. You know, as everybody has sort of been talking about, it's an insecure time to be in Egypt. It's not, you know, the Egypt that that tourists have flocked to in past years. You know, people have been very leery of leaving their money in the country, so have moved, you know, assets out. I think on the street, there's a really sort of palpable feeling that the things need to change with the economy, and they need to change quite quickly. I think another component of this that's actually pretty sad is, you know, there are people at the sort of bottom of the economic pyramid in Egypt for whom life was very, very hard before the revolution. And these are people who live in rural areas, but also people who live in urban areas in, you know, slum-like settlements, areas on the margin of the city, pockets of real urban poverty. And life for these people, which was already very difficult, you know, who are already living on the subsistence level likely before the revolution, has gotten even worse. I think that that's a very sad and pressing issue. And I think it's something that's really unifying all Egyptians to sort of say, we need to move past this point where things continue to get worse in the economy.
Wayne, go ahead.
Just very quickly, I mean, in terms of some data, you know, if you look at the population pyramid of Egypt, about half the population is under the age of 25. Right, you have about 40% of the population as of 2012 that live on less than $2 a day.
Wow.
You have structural problems, poverty, structural poverty in Egypt that is nearly impossible to reform your way out of. I mean, that's the challenge that any government there faces. And so if we go back to 2011 and we listen to what the protesters were saying, they were complaining about unemployment, they were complaining about low wages, they're complaining about the rising cost of food prices. Egypt is a country where in the past they've had bread riots when the price of bread went up because this is subsidized living for them. And when that goes away, it becomes very hard to just survive. So I think Nadine is exactly right. There is some real fundamental poverty, structural poverty built in that's really difficult to imagine being addressed in a meaningful way in such a short time. Any government that takes power faces this challenge.
Well, and given all the uncertainty, groups like Nadine's that might be interested in helping out with the economy, Wayne, are going to be a little afraid to go in there.
Absolutely. That instability, that uncertainty makes it tough to make long-term plans.
Well, and Bahat, I'd love to ask you about how your family, how they're doing economically, what they're saying about this economic crisis, if I could put it that way, and how it's affecting them.
Well, they tend to be fortunate a little bit. Everybody have jobs. They get paid not that bad. I think they can make a very good living. There is, though, a concern. Everybody knows that Egypt, it's mostly everything run by the government. So most of the people employed are employed by the government. The private sector is a lot smaller in size, kind of the opposite of what's here in the States. So people are concerned about time that will come and the government say, well, we're not able to pay the salary this month. So though people, you know, are making a living, you know, people who are making a living are still concerned that one day, you know, the check will not come.
Yeah. Well, here's a quick email that just came in from Dennis. And Wayne, I'll throw it to you. He says, what is the current status of the newly written Egyptian constitution? Great question, Dennis. Thank you.
When General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi took, basically announced that Morsi was going to be removed from office, part of that announcement included the fact that the constitution was being suspended. And that sort of makes sense in the context of a coup, of a, you know, change of power, when they installed the head of their version of the Supreme Court, basically, to run the country. So the constitution was suspended. It's troubling for lots of reasons, not the least of which is if you're trying to change a political culture, then a founding document, the social contract of the people and their government, the Constitution, is something that you want to have some sense of permanency to, and it's been suspended.
All right. Well, we will take more of your emails after a short break. Dennis, again, thanks for that one. The address, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
It's 9:39 and this is NHPR. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, mounting tensions between the U.S. and Russia, then a conversation with best-selling author Ta-Nehisi French. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon today on NHPR. And support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Goodwill Industries of Northern New England, seeking solutions that work and creating sustainable communities where nothing goes to waste. Not a shirt, not a shoe, not a person. GoodwillNNE.org. And Waste Management. In 2009, Waste Management recycled enough waste to fill the Empire State Building 12 and one-half times. Information on how this is done at thinkgreen.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the status of Medicaid expansion in the Granite State as a special commission studies the issue over the summer. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, Granite Stages with connections to Egypt look at the turmoil in that country, how the situation has been unfolding since the president was overthrown, deposed by the military last month. Let's get your thoughts and questions in to 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. If you have ties to Egypt, tell us what you're hearing from your family or contacts there. Also, if you have broad questions about what's been going on in Egypt, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And a couple more things I'd love to tease out with the four of you. One of them, and Jeannie Sowers, I think I'll go to you first. Often in this country, these conflicts are presented with a religious overthrow on it. What role is religion playing in the current stalemate or conflict or difficulty in Egypt?
Well, I think it's playing a huge role in the sense of just a sense of identity. So most, about 10% of the population is Coptic Christian, and 90% is mostly Sunni Muslim, and there's a small minority of other communities, Baha'is and Shia. And but the vast majority identifies itself as Sunni Muslim. So that gives the language of identity, and it gives the way that people frame their claims. There are parties that are explicitly calling for what they call a civil state, and they're explicitly clear that that would mean there is no religion in the actual administration of the state. But as we said, looking at the electoral results, they're less than a third of the population. So people frame their appeals to others in the language of Islam. But that doesn't mean, actually, that many of the core issues at stake are going to be only about religion. And the points that the panel made earlier about the severity of the economy are really, really important. And I just wanted to follow up on that in one brief way, which is that we've all been talking about how depressing the situation is, and it's very dangerous and it's very depressing. But we did have a year and a half of the military in power before, and I think they are going to transition to some sort of formal electoral process. And the crucial question here is going to be, can you get the Muslim Brotherhood back into play? As you know, there's all this mediation going on trying to get them involved. And they have been refusing, saying that Morsi has to be reinstated, the president has to be reinstated, which is a no-starter for the military and their allies. But really, this is the $100 million question. If you can't get them back into electoral competition, we will not have a transition to anything that looks remotely close to a democratic system. So I think, yes, religion is playing a large role. It's kind of the language of politics in many ways. But the interests that are at play are the old interests. Who controls the state? Who gets what out of the state apparatus?
Yeah, and Wayne, quick to you, and then I have a question for Baha.
I think that's really the million-dollar question that Jeannie just raised. For years, the Muslim Brotherhood was marginalized as a terrorist organization, as not allowed to play.
They were banned.
They were banned from participating in government. Then they're allowed in, and the moment they are elected democratically, they played by the rules, they gave up the violence. What happens? They are thrown out of power. And that is their perception. So really, the dangerous moment here now is you have a lot of young radicals in this organization are saying, see, when we play by the rules, they just take it away from us anyway. What's the incentive to play by the rules? That really is the big question I think a lot of us are looking to see if there's an answer for in Egypt.
Well, and another thing I wanted to clarify with all of you, and I think, Baha, I'll ask you, when we here in the West hear the military taking over, our assumption is it's bad. But as I understand, and I'd love for you to give us a little more on this, the relationship between Egyptians and the military and how much of a role they play in governance is different.
Right. The Egyptians like their army as long as the army is not in politics. And the way the army playing it this time is that they saying that, we just did the coup to carry out the will of the people who demonstrated in Tahrir Square, who were frustrated with a 1 year of bad government under the Brotherhood. And we just tried to step in to avoid bloodshed for the two groups to fight. And we stepped in, we carried out the wish, and then we stepped back. And we have now a government that is not a military government. Now, we don't know under the scene or behind the scene, who's calling the shot. Some people credit secretary of the army for being the strong man, and there's no evidence of that, on the surface.
Mahat, if I could ask you, so the military says, hey, we're just acting on behalf of the people. How does your family feel about that?
Well, again, depending whom you ask. So
yeah.
some people very happy with that. Some people against that. And interestingly, when we talk about the Brotherhood being jailed and banned, for many, many years, they have been playing the opposition role. And there was a big challenge. We talked about the difficult problems in Egypt, and their performance for a year did not please many people. Now, back again, when the Morsi was removed, since, the army involvement, they have been back on the opposition side. And in my opinion, they seem to be doing a lot better on the opposition side than being in government. That's what they have been practicing for many years.
Baha, I'd also like your thoughts, and Nadine's too, but go ahead, Baha, on what Jeannie and Wayne said about the role of religion in this.
Right. I would have to make a distinction between the leadership and the brotherhood and the rest of the troops there in the brotherhood. I would say the troops of the brotherhood would be driven by their religion feelings. That leadership are very much political. I think they use their religion, but they are very much political in nature. And they rely on their religion to achieve their goals. But they are definitely after power. And the proof for that is that they don't want to, in many cases, there are other countries where leadership found that there's a big group of people who are not happy with them, and they just step out. They say that, listen, we have been elected democratically, but we see a lot of people are not happy with us, so we're going to leave. The Brotherhood will never do that. I think they have a agenda. They want to talk about Morsi or about democratic election. They have power, and they don't want to give up easy. They don't want to let it go.
You know, Nadine, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Again, NGMA, an Egyptian group from Harvard and MIT, is, from what I understand, a lot of Egyptian Americans have a Christian background. Their parents came here a while back, like yours. I wonder what your thoughts are on the religious elements of this conflict.
Sure. I think that there's quite a bit of religious polarization happening right now in Egypt. My family is Coptic Christian, and something that's quite interesting is that around the time of Mubarak and the ouster there, many in the Christian community were very, very hesitant to speak, to join the protests or to speak out against Mubarak, because they sort of felt that they were protected under his regime. And at the time, the Coptic Pope actually urged Copts not to join the demonstrations, which, in hindsight was sort of something that some of us really wondered about, because, you know, if you don't have Copts in the square, whatever revolution happens, it's almost that they didn't participate. Today, I think, under the Muslim Brotherhood, at least Copts feel more of a sense of wanting to participate in whatever protests were happening. And I think there's a new Coptic Pope now, and he was much more hesitant to say anything like, don't join the protests, or he sort of said that, political matters should be, that's something out of the sphere of the church, and it's a personal decision whether you want to go and protest or not. So I think that there's a shift there that actually is a shift for the better. I think Copts should feel that, especially in these large demonstrations, that their Egyptianness should come first, and they should participate if that's what their views sort of are. I think that's a good thing. The other thing I think I found very interesting is there are very devout Muslims who really, really believe very strongly that what the Muslim Brotherhood was doing was wrong. And we have very good Muslim friends, a family of friends who's Muslim, who actually called the Muslim Brotherhood kafara, or people who are unbelievers. And I found that interesting. So I think, in a way, the recent political developments are making people question their religious views in contrast to their political views. And I think that those are important steps. And I think that they're growing pains, and that you don't necessarily go through that process unless you're forced to. So I think that these are positive developments, and they need to continue to happen in order for there to be a real national conversation about the role of religion in Egyptian society.
Well, and it's interesting, Jeannie, I heard just recently, we've been talking about, Muslim Brotherhood and its supporters and the military and its supporters. I heard about what's called a third square movement, Jeannie, meaning people who are just sick of the conflict and want some peace. Have you heard about this?
Well, yes. They're not really sick of the conflict. They're actually the agitators who helped create the first revolution in 2011. So
got it.
They're a group of kind of young activists who have been kind of at the forefront of helping to organize the protest in Tahrir and elsewhere. And they are the supporters of this civil state, right? So a state in which religion wouldn't be a central defining pillar. But I think that while we have the emergence of this small group, and there are human rights organizations and activists, I would say that unfortunately right now they're not representative of the mood of the country. And I think Nadine is right that there's been lots of, most of my Muslim friends voted for the Brotherhood in the presidential election because the alternative was voting for a former basically official of the old regime and a military person. So they wanted to give the Brotherhood a chance, but they were also very disillusioned with the fact that they couldn't reach out to other groups and that they didn't seem capable of sort of moving out of their own organizational base. So like Nadine, I've seen a lot of disillusionment with the Brotherhood from very pious Muslims who actually voted for Morsi. But the third square, this idea of having a civil state that respects kind of human rights irrespective of identity and religious identity, is very much a minority. And I think the other strand in Egyptian politics that we haven't talked about yet is this kind of resurgence of kind of a sort of hyper-nationalism, right? A sense of sort of Egyptian identity that actually excludes all sorts of groups with other kind of affiliations or identities. And I think it's actually very worrisome that the popular support for kind of security and some sort of stability is translating very directly into this kind of nationalist rhetoric and support for the generals, but especially the al-Sisi himself, right? So there's this kind of an attempt by the state-owned media, by sort of prominent personalities, including the daughter of Gamal Abdel Nasser. She wrote an editorial in an Arabic newspaper where she said, look, he's our new leader, our new savior. So I think there's a very real possibility that the military may reincarnate itself by running as a civilian in the next upcoming presidential
election. Al-Sisi being the head of the armed forces,
yes.
Jeannie. Yeah. And, well, what you said just flows perfectly into an email that just came in from Will in Hancock. And Will, thank you very much. He says, I'd like to ask, even if the Egyptian military is able to successfully conduct an election for a new government, how fair would it be? Would the Muslim Brotherhood be able to participate? Wayne, what do you think?
We don't know. I mean, there's lots of questions we don't have answers for. Certainly, there are lots of outside forces, Europeans, the Americans, the UN, other organizations that would like to have election monitors in place. I mean, all of those pieces could happen if the government would allow it. But you know, in the past, the government hasn't been as friendly as it could have been to organizations that were there to promote democracy. So there are a lot of unanswered questions. We really don't know if the Muslim Brotherhood is going to play the political game again. I think Bahat's right. There are a lot of young people who are prone to radicalization now, seeing that the experience they just had. The answer is we just don't know.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear your sort of thoughts for the future, Bahat, how optimistic you are that if these elections come, they will be free and fair, as we say in this country.
I can tell, really, it's very hard to read what's going to happen. One question is going to be, as we said, what role the Brotherhood will play. The Salafi movement have been playing on both sides. They sided with the army change, but in the meantime, they are still on the ground with the Brotherhood. So they are playing both sides. Mm. They don't want to be. They don't want to lose, depending on whoever side win. The other thing is that, on the liberal side or the non-brotherhood side, trying to choose the right word to call them, people can't see people now who would run for the presidency. So if that happened in a few months, well, who else is going to run? You need some strong figures, and that's not really there. And the old figure that came over the past 2 years, I would think people like to see new faces.
Yeah. Nadine, love your thoughts and hopes and fears for Egypt's future, especially as everybody looks toward A, hopefully the squares don't blow up with more violence, and B, these elections.
I think in the short term, it will probably continue to be a sort of tumultuous transition period in Egypt. I think the tendency to focus on elections as a real bellwether of democracy is an interesting thing that we do in the U.S. I think, democracy in Egypt has to do a lot more than elections, including civil society, for example, which is very, very weak. So I think looking to the next, decade, for example, for Egypt to really grow into a thriving and robust democracy, I think at a grassroots level, at least, and our organization NGMA is, very interested in this. We really want to work with interested, concerned citizens, activists, grassroots level people to strengthen civil society in Egypt. And so we can really work in the next phase to promote the type of thinking and that leads to, good decisions at the polls. So perhaps in the short term, it will still be a rocky period, but I think if we continue to work to hone civil society and to strengthen it and to get people interested and bought into the development of Egypt in the next phase, then elections maybe in 5 years or 10 years will be more representative of the people's demands.
We've got sort of a short-term focus in this country is what you're saying, Nadine. Need to look at the long term. All of you, this has been great and really interesting. Thank you so much for being here. Baha, good to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That's Baha El-Aidi. He's an engineering consultant born in Egypt. He's lived in New Hampshire since 2002. Nadine Farag, it was great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Nadine Farag, secretary of NGMA, an Egyptian group from Harvard and MIT. Jeannie Sowers, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Jeannie Sowers, assistant professor of political science at UNH and a Middle East analyst for the Congressional Research Service. And Wayne L'Esperance, again, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
Wayne L'Esperance, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. This week, it is David Darman. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, mulling over Medicaid expansion. At the end of the legislative season, New Hampshire lawmakers decided to spend the summer studying whether the Granite State should accept federal funds to extend Medicaid to more residents. A special commission has held weekly sessions on this with a deadline of mid-October. We'll find out what they're looking at and what they may decide. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
This is NHPR. The Diane Rehm Show is next. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Comcast Business, lending support and applauding the work of organizations such as the Manchester Young Professionals Network. Additional information at mypn.org. And Rath Young and Pignatelli, with law offices in Concord, Nashua, and Boston. National impact, uniquely New Hampshire. On the web at rathlaw.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In a press conference Friday, President Obama defended his decision to hit pause on the U.S.-Russia relationship. Over the past several months, differences have emerged over Syria and human rights. He said NSA